Ever wonder what goes on at the SEC, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission? That's the agency whose primary purpose is to make sure that the financial service providers in this country operate within the law to ensure the overall economic health of the country. Let's take a look inside this SEC to find out. And to do that, I've invited Norm Champ. Norm is the former director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC. And he has a new book. It's entitled Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. Also, Mr. Champ is a lecturer on investment management at Harvard Law School. Welcome to the show, Norm.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve. Really appreciate it.
So I didn't know you could have adventures inside the SEC, but we'll just pass that for a second. Look, in 2008, Americans were reeling from the devastating financial crisis that caused the Great Recession. We all know about this. We've all felt it. And there were a lot of questions about how the crisis was allowed to happen. And then, of course, calls for immediate reform. And then, the multiple scandals like the Madoff scandal sent real fear throughout the investment community. And it put a lot of pressure on the SEC. So right about that time in 2010, you joined the SEC. Why did you join at that time?
Yep. So I took the oath in January of 2010, and that was really, just right after the crisis. I think the main motivation for me was that I had worked with the SEC my whole career, right, as a young lawyer, working on offerings and working on M&A deals and speaking with SEC people and working with them. And they had this reputation as this expert agency that was fulfilling the mission of markets in the United States and capital formation. And here they were, I think, of any agency in the crisis, they took the biggest tumble from being that expert to being basically derided all around the street. And it was hard to watch. And I thought that I had this expertise around expert asset management and that it would make sense to come in and try to offer some of that expertise to help them fulfill their mission.
Well, you were still on the outside. And what did you actually think you would find once you got there?
So I thought that it would be more expert than it was. I thought it would be more market savvy than it is. It's a place where people end up staying a long time because it has tremendous, it has tremendous benefits and sort of lifetime employment. You can never be fired. And so it had gotten a little stagnant in its thinking about markets and what it was doing, and things had really gotten ossified. It was much more bureaucratic and ossified and sort of, doing things the way they did them because they always did them that way. There was much more of that than I expected.
Yeah, so there was this idea of what you thought you would find when you got in there, and then what you actually did find. Would you characterize that as being much worse?
Yes. So some of it, I often, say to people, some of it you just couldn't make up, right? The idea that the examiners who were examining Madoff, examining Stanford, the idea that they had no manual, no framework of how to conduct exams and what to do when they went to conduct exams and what to look for was just stunning. Because SEC rules require investment advisors and broker-dealers to have manuals to set out how they're going to do their job, how you're going to prevent fraud, how you're going to protect the client, all those things. And yet, my second or third week, the examiners asked me, well, how do you want this exam done? And I said, well, don't we have some guidance, some sort of framework? Well, we sort of, we kind of know how to do these things.
Yeah,
and that easily was the biggest surprise.
Well, I mean, the irony is so that, I've been in the investment world for 35 years. And you're right. The amount of material and requirements and manuals and checklists, and I mean, it goes on and on and on. What we are required to have on premises and in our compliance departments and the like is incredible. And you're basically, I'm hearing from you, they don't follow their own rules.
So there was very little infrastructure, very little setting down of how you're going to do things. And one of the lasting accomplishments of what we did while we were there was to get a manual in place in the exam division and also get a manual in place in the Division of Investment Management. Those are things that will be there for I think, a long time, and people will follow them, and I think that will help protect investors and help the SEC get back on its feet.
In the private sector, you have the ability as a manager to install monetary rewards, monetary carrots. In the public sector, are monetary rewards appropriate?
They are, and I would like to see more of them. The real crux of the cultural problems in government now, and this is not just the SEC, this is across all kinds of governments. The real crux of the problem is there are neither carrots nor sticks. So the SEC and the public employee union that represents employees there could never agree on a pay-for-performance system. So there was no way to reward the high performers and pay them more. And so when we did surveys of employees, that was the number one sticking point, right? Because people come in there, they're devoted to the mission, they kill themselves, they work really hard. The guy two doors down is doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
And that inability to reward the hard worker makes the government environment very difficult.
So was the union, the public employees union, is that very, very strong in the SEC or across government?
They are very strong at the SEC and very strong across many arms of the federal government and similar to the state level. And it is something that they help make the culture very difficult because they are constantly trying to get more benefits for their employees, right?
Sure.
They don't have to do day-to-day work for the SEC if they are the union rep. So their goal is to be reelected as the union rep, which means you got to get more benefits for employees. Now,
I see.
To me, that's actually pretty logical. I mean, in other words, a lot of my colleagues railed at that. I was like, look, this guy wants to get reelected. He's going to try to get more benefits for employees. That's what he's doing.
That's the job of the union, is to get more benefits.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to expect him not to is not that realistic. Now, of course, I would love to see some changes so that they weren't able to do that, but we had the system we had. And so one of the things I really sort of made a strategic decision right away was that I wanted to work with them because, you know, they were there long before I was. They're going to be there long after, right?
Yeah.
If I fight them and try to punch them in the nose, it's just not going to happen. So, and they had some motivation to make some changes as well because their examiners were being pilloried in the paper and there was all these, you know, there was a lot of heat. And so I spoke to the union every Tuesday morning for 5 years and we worked to make a lot of changes together. And I really put my effort on that as opposed to trying to fire people. Some people come in, they're like, you know, I'm going to fire this guy, fire that guy. Effectively, you cannot fire anyone because of civil service rules and the union rules. So you spend a lot of brain damage on trying to fire somebody and you don't get anywhere.
But you mentioned in the book that, and I'm going to quote here, quiet patriots who triumph despite the system. It sounds great. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. So you have all this chaos, you have a lot of things going on, and you have people who aren't doing their jobs. And yet, you have people who come there, they're there for public service, they want to do the right thing, they want to protect investors, they want to make things better. And so it's those people that the book is dedicated to because they screen out all this noise and they're out there protecting investors every day. And they're doing it in ways that mostly the public will never know about. So one example that I talk about in the book that I think is most telling is there was a broker-dealer that was in a lot of trouble in 2011, almost failed, and that failure would have been the largest failure of a U.S. broker-dealer by far, by number of accounts and by amounts of people impacted. And literally a team of people worked behind the scenes tirelessly, you know, traveling away from their homes for weeks, months at a time, doing everything they could to essentially, we found a buyer ultimately for it. And you know, in the end, we got someone to buy most of the assets, the rest of the assets declared bankruptcy, and investors were not harmed. No one had to go through a SIPC proceeding to sort out a bankrupt broker dealer, right? And that's one of those ones where you see people just sacrificing everything.
Is that the function of someone in SEC to find a buyer for a troubled company?
Not usually, but in the immediate post-crisis, you know, meltdown atmosphere, I think we all felt like we had to get more involved. You just couldn't. Yeah, you just couldn't have another failure because there was so much attention and so much going on. And so you're right. I would say ordinarily probably not, but in those kind of crisis times, people went above and beyond. And I feel like those are the kind of people that, and every improvement I tried to make at the SEC was to help those people be able to do their job better, you know, be able to prove it so that they could do better.
My guest is Norm Champ, the former director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC, and his new book is Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. So you left when?
So I left in January of 2015.
Okay. And you went to go back to the private sector? What are you doing now? Or you went to write a book.
Yeah, right. Yep. First thing I did was I went to write a book. So I took a whole year off, rented one of these shared workspaces on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and one of these, you know, group office places. And I worked on the book for a year. And I spoke to a variety of different people about opportunities and ultimately ended up back in private practice at a law firm and have been helping investment funds comply with the law since then. So that's mostly what I do.
One of the policies that you were instrumental in passing or areas of reform was the money market mutual fund reform. What is that? What was the problem and how was it reformed?
So in the fall of 2008, while everything else was falling apart, one main feature of the U.S. financial system was falling apart and it didn't get as much publicity as the rest of it. Money market mutual funds are something that almost all of us are invested in, but most of us don't even know we're invested in. So if you have a securities account somewhere, Fidelity, you know, Vanguard, whatever, you mostly have your spare cash in a money market mutual fund that's earning a little extra return as you wait to put it into a new investment or what have you. You probably filled out a form when you opened that account 20 years ago, and you don't even know that your money's going into that money market mutual fund. That's all fine. Those funds, essentially, if you put a dollar in, you get a dollar out, like a bank account. And nobody really paid any attention to any of this until the fall of 2008, when after Lehman went bankrupt on September 15th, 2008, a money market mutual fund called Reserve Primary woke up to find out that it owned $680 million worth of Lehman Brothers debt. And all of a sudden, putting a dollar in was not going to get a dollar out.
This was a relatively small money market too, wasn't it?
No, they were the biggest. They were one of the biggest. Yep.
They rivaled the ones you just mentioned, like Fidelity and...
They did, because they were offering better returns for primarily for institutional investors. And so they had attracted a lot of capital. Okay. And so when they woke up owning a lot of what then became, at least for the moment, worthless paper from Lehman Brothers, people started withdrawing like crazy from the money market mutual
funds. Like a bank
now,
run on the bank.
It's a run on the bank for mutual funds. And Treasury and the Fed stepped in and guaranteed all money market mutual funds in the United States.
Yeah.
Ironically, they did so with a $34 million, M as in million, dollar fund. Money market funds were around $3 trillion.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say, what is that going to do?
What $34 million was going to do? But it shows the power of psychology and financial markets.
I gotcha.
It stopped the run on the funds.
Yeah.
But it was incumbent on the SEC, which had created this product and allowed the fixed dollar price. It was incumbent on the SEC to get organized and figure out how to reform these funds so this wouldn't happen again.
So I remember, I don't know, maybe a year ago, we got a notice. Our custodian is Fidelity. We got a notice saying that the law had changed and that now the mutual fund could break the buck, as they say.
Yep.
The dollar price per share could go below. It would start to fluctuate.
Yes.
And I think we were told if we wanted to prevent that, then put your money in a government-backed money market, which we automatically did. So is that the rule that you're referring to?
Yes. And so after a long saga, we got that rule passed in the summer of 2014, and that's why you got that notice in 16, because it was about a two-year implementation period. And effectively what it said was, look, this product is an investment product. It's not a dollar-in, dollar-out bank account.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
so we want people to understand that it can fluctuate in value, and that's what the new rule says. Now, you are correct. Your memory's great. It does allow the government funds to stay at a dollar. I was not necessarily a huge fan of that part of it, or retail funds staying at a dollar.
But
nonetheless, we got a substantial part of that market turned into a floating price.
I can see the issue, because now that everybody's going to be moving to the government, it doesn't really take the responsibility or the liability away from the government. It just kind of loads it more directly on them as opposed to indirectly on them.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's had another impact, which we knew, which was a lot of people relied on that short-term funding coming into those money market mutual funds.
Yeah.
And so, now you're moving that to the government. So that funding has had to come from elsewhere over the last couple of years, many more credit funds and those kind of people providing finance.
Be careful how you fix something, right? It always has some consequence somewhere else.
Agreed.
Yeah.
But I was pleased that we were able to get a significant chunk of the industry to a floating net asset value. I would have preferred all of it, but politics is the art of compromise. So we got much of it to floating.
All right. So also there's the Volcker Rule and Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform. We don't really have that much time, a couple of minutes. What involvement did you have there and what did you take away from that?
So the SEC was one of the five agencies that had to write the Volcker Rule. You know, the Volcker Rule is just, it's nothing but Glass-Steagall turned into a big bureaucratic rule. So
were you going to say mess or?
Yes. I mean, we could have had Glass-Steagall where you just separate banks and investment banks.
That's what
instead,
I liked.
They kept them together and they wrote the Volcker Rule to try to separate the two impacts.
Yeah.
It's a complicated rule. It gives a lot of power to regulators. I don't really think it helps safety and soundness very much, but doesn't look to me like there's going to be much appetite to change it in the new administration. So it seems like it's here to stay.
One last thing. You had addressed this. You're in favor of increased financial literacy and education, of course, and who isn't? But you mentioned one thing here. Force the lottery to do truthful advertising. What is that all about?
So after making a bunch of policy recommendations in Chapter 10, I do think that the number one way that Americans can prepare for the next crisis is to improve their own balance sheets, increase their own savings, use tax-free savings accounts, which are one of the rare breaks offered by the IRS system. And one of the things that's so frustrating is the government, instead of encouraging savings, encouraging individuals to create their own balance sheets and strengthen their own balance sheets, instead advertises relentlessly the worst investment in human history, which is the lottery.
Yeah.
The lottery's a monopoly. They pay about half of the what they take in out to the people who win, and then they tax even that over a certain level.
Right.
Your odds of winning are about the same as being hit by lightning. And the saddest part, low-income New Yorkers spend, and I talk about this in the book, low-income New Yorkers spend about 10% of their income on lottery tickets.
Oh, wow.
I could take that income. You could. We could invest that in a tax-free account.
Absolutely.
Those people would have a net worth.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to, the lottery is exempt from truth in advertising laws. It's a monopoly. Mm-hmm. I would like to see big changes there to stop this tax, which is a regressive tax on the lower income Americans.
Wow, that's a very good point. Norm Champ is my guest, the former director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC. His new book is Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. And obviously, it's a book about what has happened, what is currently happening, and also Norm's thoughts about other things that need to be fixed. To find out more about Norm and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join us and join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Thank you so much for joining me, Norm. It was great.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.